Glad you're here today. We had a good restful vacation. Have you ever been to the middle of nowhere and nowhere? That's where we were. I mean, the closest Walmart was like an hour and 15 minutes away. And so we got to our resort on that Sunday evening, and Audrey said, guess what? You and Emmy are going to Walmart. So we drove to Walmart, shopped there, came back. We just rested. We enjoyed the vacation. If you'd like a great place to go to that's in the middle of nowhere, nowhere, Waterside Resort is it. You sit in the resort and look out over the Albemarle Sound. If you've ever been that direction on Highway 32, there's a 3.5-mile bridge that goes across that sound. So if you want to go to middle of nowhere, nowhere, that's it. But we had a great time. We're glad to be back. Have you had a good week so far? All right, one person. All right, I'll ask you again. Have you had a good week so far? Good, all right. And I'm glad you're here today. You go ahead and take out your sermon notes and take your Bibles, if you brought them, and turn to Ruth chapter 2. We are in the middle of a series on the book of Ruth. And before we do that, I just want to turn around and say to somebody, good morning, or glad you're here. When I was thinking about this sermon, I thought, how can I introduce this sermon we're going to look at today? How many of you would say, I just absolutely love going to the dentist? Nobody. One person, my wife. Yeah, she's on drugs this morning, by the way, okay? I hate going to the dentist. I hate it. It's not the dentist, it's the needles. I'm a baby when it comes to needles. I can kind of handle the ones in the side of the mouth. Years ago, I had a great dentist. He told me that if a dentist is doing it right, he will massage your gums back and forth. He will massage them a little bit for about a minute and slowly stick the needle in, slowly keep working that needle in, and then slowly push that syringe to where the Novocaine goes in. And he says you shouldn't feel really anything. If you feel something, it means he's rushing, okay? But the ones I can't handle are in the roof of my mouth. You ever had those? If you haven't, bless your heart, okay? My blood pressure will go up through the roof. And years ago, I had to have some wisdom teeth cut out. And my dentist says, we got to give you needles up in the roof of your mouth. I said, oh, no, you're not. It ain't happening. He said, oh, yes, we will. I said, well, I don't understand. How can you massage these and I don't feel it, but when you do this, I do? He says, well, there's very little tissue there in the roof of your mouth. I said, okay. I said, well, you're not going to be able to do this. I said, I can tell you my blood pressure is up through the roof. My blood pressure is normally 90 over 60. He told one of his attendants, bring in a BP, let's check him. My blood pressure was 280 over 180. He said, if I pull your wisdom teeth, you'll bleed out. I said, I told you. So guess what? They gave me happy juice. So now when I go to the dentist, if they have to do the roof, I say, hey, happy juice. That's the only way I can get through it. Because if not, my blood pressure will absolutely go up through the roof. Okay? I had the wisdom teeth pulled. Everything was great. I didn't feel anything until 2 days later when I got a dry socket. And then I felt it. I read about a middle-aged man who went for a routine physical. His wife had been on to him. He'd never gone. And she said, you're getting older. You need to go to the doctor and get a physical. So he went in, and the nurse said, we're here to check you out. We're going to do a full physical on you, so I need to ask you, how much do you weigh? He says, well, about 165. And she was looking at him, and she's going, oh, no, he's lying. She told him, step on the scale. She said, sir, you're not 165. You're 210 pounds. She said, how tall are you? He said, I'm about 6 feet. And she looked at him and said, oh, he's lying again. She said, step over here against the wall. I'm going to measure how high you are. He wasn't 6 feet. He was only 5 feet, 8.5 inches. She took his blood pressure and she said, sir, do you know your blood pressure is up through the roof? He said, well, why would you not expect it to be high? She said, why is it high? He said, when I came in here, I was tall and lanky and you just informed me I'm short and fat. Well, I say that in this way. There are times we all have to endure some painful experiences. We just have to push through them. We don't like them. We don't want them, but we have to push through them. And in our story today, in the book of Ruth, we're going to see how God is working behind the scenes to help push some people through some difficult situations in order to accomplish his will so that eventually, 3 generations later, King David would be born, and 1,000 years later, Jesus Christ would be born. It's going to be tough for Ruth. It's going to be tough for Naomi. But God's going to push them through these painful experiences to get them where they need to be. So we're in this series about how does God work in all things? I believe with all my heart that God does work in all things to bring about good, to accomplish his will, no matter what it is. And if you remember in our last time in this book, we left it on a very bitter note. Elimelech, who is the patriarch of the family, when there was a famine in Bethlehem, decided to uproot the family and move across the Jordan River to a country called Moab. He takes his wife and his two twin sons. And over a 10-year period, his sons marry Moabite women. One is named Orpah, one is named Ruth. But at the end of the 10 years, we learn that not only has Elimelech died, and we're not told why, we're told that their two twin sons have died. So by the time we get to the last time we were in this book, we have three widows, Naomi, Ruth, and Orpah. Naomi gets word that the famine has ended, so she decides she's going to go back home. Her two daughter-in-laws go with her to a certain point, to which Naomi says, hey, you need to go back to Moab, you need to go back to your gods, to your families, and let your families find you other husbands. Orpah does that, but Ruth does not. Ruth says, I'm going with you. Your God will be my God. Your people will be my people. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. And she will take no for an answer, and she follows her mother-in-law home. And by the time Naomi gets home, everybody's excited. They run out to greet her. You remember that? They're excited. Oh, Naomi's here. Naomi's here. And we saw that when Naomi arrives, she's a different woman 10 years later. She's bitter. She's lost her husband. She's lost her twin sons. And she's bitter. She tells the folks, do not call me Naomi, which means pleasant, gracious, kind. Call me Mara, bitter. And she brings an indictment against God. She says, God is the one who has made me this way. So her name, as you see there, means pleasant, lovely, delicate. But she wants to be called bitter. Look at verses 19 through 20 of Ruth 1. When they came to Bethlehem, the entire town was excited by their arrival. Is it really Naomi? The women asked. Don't call me Naomi. She responded instead, call me Mara, for the Almighty has made life very bitter for me. So that word Mara means bitter. And I ask you in this sermon, have you ever been around a bitter person? They're not pleasant to be around because their bitterness is like a poison. It not only poisons them, it poisons everyone who surrounds them. She doesn't want to be called gracious, pleasant, loving, kind. Call me bitter because it's God's fault. So in this indictment she brings against God, God is still going to work behind the scenes. She has no idea by the time they get to chapter 2, God has been working his will, working events, working circumstances to bring about his will, which will impact her life in a good way, as well as a woman named Ruth. All she thinks she has to live for now is survival. All she thinks is that as she walks through the city streets, people go, oh, look, there's poor, pitiful, bitter old Naomi. I guess we should help her. And while Naomi has abandoned God, she's about to learn in chapter 2, God has never abandoned her. Her life is about to do a 180 very quickly in the next 24 hours in chapter 2. You see, when many people read the book of Ruth, they'll say something like, well, isn't Naomi lucky that her life began 180 degrees 24 hours later? Luck has nothing to do with it. Listen to me. There is no such thing as good luck or bad luck. There's no such thing as good karma or bad karma. There is the Lord for believers, and there is Lucifer for everyone. Listen to me. If you are a type of person that says, as a believer, I'm lucky, that in Scripture is called blasphemy. Christians should never use the word luck or good luck or bad luck or good karma or bad karma or I guess the stars were all arranged for me. No, that's blasphemous because you're not giving God credit for everything good in your life. Look at James. Every good and perfect gift comes to us from where? God. It doesn't come from luck. So quit using the word luck if you're a believer. And if you're not a believer, quit using it. Most people read this story, and I've heard people tell me this story over and over through my life. Ruth and Naomi were just lucky. There is no luck here. It's the Lord working behind the scenes. And for a believer living in a generation, we are prone to use the words of our culture to express how good things are. I'm encouraging us as a people of faith, whatever good is in your life, give all the credit to Jesus Christ, because that's why it's good. And though we may not hear voices, there may not be any angels that appear that direct us on our way, God is still working behind the scenes, even when your life seems turned upside down, even when things seem horrible or bad. And when I was preparing for this, I thought about a verse I had to memorize when I was a small child in Sunday school, Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. I'll read it from the NLT. I memorized it in NASB, but it says this: trust in the Lord with all your heart. Do not depend on your own understanding. Seek his will in all that you do, and he will show you which path to take. Whatever's going on in your life, however bad it may be, trust the Lord. He is working behind the scenes to work this out for his glory. It's not luck that makes it turn around. It's the Lord. It's not a coincidence that turns it around. It's Christ. And I imagine when the prophet Samuel, who most scholars think is the author of this book, was penning this book, he does what a lot of good authors do. He gives us an opening statement in chapter 2, verse 1, which in literature is called foreshadowing. And if you've ever taken a literature class, you know what foreshadowing is. Foreshadowing is a statement or paragraph that lets you kind of know how the rest of the story is going to go. It sets the theme. And that's chapter 2, verse 1. Look at it. There is this unbelievable statement. Now, there was a wealthy... I love this. There was this wealthy man, an influential man in Bethlehem named Boaz, who was a relative of Naomi's husband, Elimelech. So with this brief statement, now you read it in the English, you miss it, because in the Hebrew, it's loaded, giving us a lot of quick biographical information about this man named Boaz. Verse 1 is kind of a loaded biographical statement of this man that God's going to use to eventually become the wife of Ruth, who they will have a son named Obed, who will have a son named Jesse, and who Jesse will have a son named who? David. Who 1,000 years later will be the ancestor to Jesus Christ. Naomi doesn't see this. Ruth doesn't see this. They think they're just two widows living back home, and nobody's going to care for them. What they don't realize, in verse 1, God's got it already worked out. And as we see in this story, it will not be luck. It will be the Lord. And whatever's going on in your life, I said again, whatever bad's going on in your life, whatever's trying going on in your life, ride it out. Push through it. Because God is going to make you see sunshine soon. So what's the first quick thing we learn here about Boaz? First, it's in his name. Boaz's name in Hebrew literally means lively, swiftness, and quickness. And we're going to come to see how he lives up to his name in the rest of chapter 2, 3, and 4 as we make our way through the book. The second thing we see here is the Bible defines him as a relative of Naomi. Okay, you'll see there. The Hebrew word used in verse 1, chapter 2, is the Hebrew word yoda or moda. It literally means kinsman. And this is going to be a theme in the book of Ruth, that the Old Testament set aside what's called a kinsman redeemer. If a husband died and he had no sons, God took care of that, because in those days, in the Old Testament day, a woman was cared for, taken care of by her husband, or if he died, her sons. If she had neither, God put a provision in the Old Testament law for that widow to be cared for. It's called the kinsman redeemer. And we're going to see how God will use Boaz to become that kinsman redeemer for Ruth. Here's a third thing we learn. Though the Bible does not tell us how he is related to Naomi, what is called an other rabbinic tradition, meaning tradition that was passed down through the centuries by rabbis since this story, they kind of give us an indication how Boaz is related to Naomi. It's found in the Bara Batra. It states that Salmon, who is Boaz's father, was the brother to Elimelech. Okay? In essence, what this does, here's your villain. Boaz is Naomi's nephew. That's how he is related. And because he's the nephew, he is the first in line to care for Naomi as well as eventually Ruth. The Old Testament provided a clause in it to make sure that a woman who was a widow, who had no sons, was cared for. Here it is in Deuteronomy 25. If two brothers are living together on the same property and one of them dies without a son, his widow may not be married to anyone from outside the family. Instead, her husband's brother should marry her and have intercourse with her to fulfill the duties of a brother-in-law. The first son she bears to him will be considered the son of the dead brother, so that his name will not be forgotten in Israel. Now, we don't do that in America, but that's how God provided that that legacy would continue on down. We're going to see that Naomi is unaware that Boaz is aware of this commandment in the Old Testament law. And Boaz, by the time we work our way through chapter 2 and get to chapter 3, he will implement this as a way to marry Ruth. Now, Ruth has no idea that Boaz is related to Naomi, but she's soon to find out. Again, it's how God works things behind the scenes. And I could have gone on a lot of different directions with this morning, but the thing that stood out to me as I was working on this weeks and weeks ago was how God uses us to influence others to continue in their walk and their faith with God when things get bad. All of us go through terrible things. All of us get discouraged at times. All of us need someone influencing us. Hang in there. Trust God. Toe the line. Read the word. Pray to God. Keep going. God also uses us to influence people who are not believers to become believers. So this morning, I want to talk about how can we be an influencer for the glory of God, okay? To really influence others for Jesus Christ around you, here's the first thing you have to be. You got to be strong in your relationship with the Lord. And we're going to see just how strong Boaz is in his relationship with God. I'll tell you up front, he has a very strong relationship with God. Let's look at it again in Ruth 2, verse 1. Now there was a wealthy and influential man in Bethlehem named Boaz, who was a relative of Naomi's husband. The English Standard Version puts it this way. Now Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. Now this word that's translated as wealthy, influential, or worthy is the Hebrew word shareel. And I'm going to give you multiple ways this word is used in the Old Testament because every one of those uses describes who Boaz is. It gives us an indication of his character, the type of man he is, or the type of man he was. We see this word used, first of all, in Joshua 6:2. The Lord said to Joshua, "See, I have given Jericho into your hand with its kings and its valiant warriors." Shael was a word that was used to refer to very valiant soldiers, men who were tough in battle, who did not quit, who did not go AWOL. In fact, the same word is used later. You remember when Absalom opposed David and eventually kicked him off the throne temporarily, and he decides he's going to take his army and go to war and fight David? One of Absalom's advisors named Hushai said, "You don't want to do that. You don't want to do that." Look at this in 2 Samuel 17. Moreover, Hushai said, "You know your father and his men, that they are mighty men and they are fierce, like a bear robbed of her cubs in the field. And your father is an expert in warfare," meaning Absalom, you're not, "and will not spend the night with the people. And even the one who's valiant," Shael, there's that word, "whose heart is like the heart of a lion, will completely lose heart. For all of Israel knows that your father is a mighty man, and those who are with him are valiant," or Shael, meaning. What Hushai said to Absalom, "Do not go to war against David. You will die. No ifs, ands, or buts about it." So what does this tell us about Boaz? The first way this word gives us an indication of who Boaz was it indicates that he was a person who was a veteran soldier. That's the first thing we learn about him. You remember, this is the period of the judges. This is the period of a man named Gideon, who was a judge. And there is many biblical scholars who believe that Boaz had been one of the mighty, valiant warriors. Remember, Gideon, God called him to use 300 men to defeat their enemies. And there are a lot of biblical scholars who believe that Boaz was one of those 300 men. So there is an indication he was a veteran soldier. Here's the second way this word Shael was used in the Old Testament. It was used to refer to a person of great influence. You see there on the screen, it says that there was a wealthy, influential Shiloh man named Kish from the tribe of Benjamin. He was the son of Abiel, the son of Zaor, the son of Bechorah, the son of Alphiah, and the tribe of Benjamin. So all of that reference there is to veteran soldiers, men who go to war. Here's the second way it was used. It was used to refer of great influence. We realize because of his wealth, of his status, of his age, he was highly respected in Bethlehem. We see another reference to such a man in 2 Kings. Menahem extracted the money from Israel, that is, from all the wealthy Shiloh men, 50 shekels of silver from every man to give the king of Assyria. So the king of Assyria turned back and did not stay there in the land. So it refers to men who have great influence. Here's a third way this word was used, Shiloh, referred to a person of great wealth. A person of great wealth. We see this again in Ruth 2, verse 1. Now there was a wealthy Shiloh, an influential man in Bethlehem named Boaz, who was a relative of Naomi's husband. The word used for wealth means exceedingly wealthy. He would have been the Bill Gates of his day. Here's the fourth way this word Shiloh was used, referred to a person who had godly character. He was a man who loved God, who had this passionate love for God. He lived a godly life. He was a righteous man. Look how this is said in Ruth 3:11. Boaz said to Ruth, "Now don't worry about a thing, my daughter." You hear the tenderness in his voice, the sensitivity in his voice. "I will do what is necessary, for everyone in town knows that you are a virtuous Shiloh woman." So it's a reference here to now Ruth's character. It's used of godly character about Boaz, but now we also learn that Ruth has godly character. Remember, she's a Moabite. She was raised to worship pagan gods in Moab. The chief pagan god in Moab was Chemosh. Chemosh required that you had to at least sacrifice one of your children you had to him. You may have had 10, you got to sacrifice one. You may have had 3, you had to sacrifice one. So Ruth has come out of a pagan culture that believes in child sacrifices, but she has decided in her journey with Naomi to accept the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, because she has seen something different in this God than she has seen in her own gods. She's looked at how Naomi blames God. Ruth doesn't. Naomi believes that God has abandoned her. What she doesn't realize, God is already working behind the scenes to take care of her as well as Ruth. And God is going to use this wonderful man named Boaz to be the kinsman redeemer to do that. Has there ever been a time in your life you thought that God had abandoned you and later you saw how he'd been working behind the scenes? We all have. Did you stop and give him credit for it when you realized it? When you told the story, did you give God credit for it, for working behind the scenes? Do you really want to be a person of influence for God? Here's the second thing that's required. You need to be spiritually encouraging to everyone. To everyone. We're going to see that Boaz is spiritually encouraging to everyone he meets. You can't help but notice that when Boaz first arrives on the scene, he walks out in the fields to talk to those he's hired to glean the wheat. Look at what it says in verse 4. Boaz himself arrived in Bethlehem and greeted the workers. "The Lord be with you," he said. "The Lord bless you," they answered. Now, don't skip over this greeting. In typical Jewish tradition, when they greeted each other, they would use the word shalom, peace be to you. This is not the traditional greeting that Boaz used. He does something that would be considered by most Jews pushing the line. He uses the most sacred, holy name for God to greet his workers, and that is Yahweh. So when it translates, "May the Lord be with you," he's saying, "May Yahweh, the God of I am that I am, the God who let us know who he was to Moses, may that God be with you." And they respond in kind, "May the Lord, may Yahweh be with you." Have you ever noticed in our culture how we kind of do things in our greetings? You come up to somebody, you get to work tomorrow morning, you look at your coworker, "Hey, how you doing? You doing okay?" They go, "Yeah, I'm fine. And you, how are you doing?" And then everybody goes to work, right? Isn't it amazing in our culture that sometimes even our greetings become so ritualistic, we don't even really hear what people say? Several years ago, this company did this study on greetings. They wanted to know, do we really listen? Or have we already prepared in advance what we think they're going to say, and so we respond? So people were paid to come in, and when asked, hey, how are you doing? Instead of saying, fine, I'm doing okay, they said, well, I've just learned I got stage 4 cancer and I'm going to be dead in a month. The majority of the people, when they heard that, they said, great, I hope you have a wonderful day. They didn't even hear what was said. Why? Because they weren't listening to hear what was said. Because even in our greetings at times to each other, it's a ritual we do just to get to the next thing. Years ago, I was in a personnel team meeting, and the chairman, we joke about it. We've been joking about it ever since. He called us to pray, and somebody prayed, and he said, now that we got that over with, let's get to the main thing. And I said, whoa, 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 whoa. I said, prayer is not an item on the agenda. Prayer is the agenda. And sometimes even when we come together in our ministry team meetings here, we use prayer as an item on the agenda just to get to what we think is really important. What would happen if every team that has a ministry here came together and every team member went around and prayed about what God wanted them to do rather than just, all right, Audrey, lead us in prayer. All right, now that's done. Let's get to the real thing. Prayer is the agenda. And sometimes even in church, we fall prey to this cultural tradition of just going through the motions to do the ritual in order to get to what we think is very important. Boaz, instead of giving the traditional greeting of Shalom, says, may Yahweh, the God who is I am that I am, may he be with you. And you see, by invoking the name of Yahweh, Boaz wasn't just asking God to be a blessing to them. He was asking God to bless them, to bless others, and to bless their lives, to bless their families. Okay, what would happen tomorrow if you go to work? Let me ask you this. If you go to work tomorrow, and your boss came up behind you, put his hand or her hand on your shoulder and said, I hope you experience the presence of God today as you work here. Would you have a heart attack? Yeah, you probably would. If you supervise people at work, what would happen if you went up to every worker you supervise and said, you know, I'm glad you work for me. I'm glad you work for this company. May you experience the Lord's presence as you work here today or as you work for me. You see, that's what Boaz does, because he knows gleaming the fields is not the main goal. What's the main goal is giving God credit that he has fields to glean. They've just come out of a famine, and now the wheat, the barley, is starting to grow again. You see, here's the way I look at this. When you go to work tomorrow, walk up to a coworker and say, I just hope today you experience the presence of God in your life. They may look at you like a horse at a new gate. Or they may tear up and say, you know, no one's ever said anything like that to me. Yeah, they may run to your boss and say, that person is a little too religious. Here's the way I look at this. There is more to risk in not doing this than in doing this. Even in the church, we need to be more serious about how we address each other, how we listen to each other. It's so easy when we read these stories to think, well, you know, Boaz has some hint that Samuel's going to write about him and put him in a book one day. Boaz has no idea he's going to be written about. But what we do know is that Boaz was sincere. He takes the most sacred, holy name of God to Jews, Yahweh, a name that most Jews would never even say because they feared that they'd be struck dead if they did, as a way to say, may you experience the presence of God today as you work in these fields. When you greet someone, how are you doing? Is it just a ritual you go through? Or are you genuinely and sincerely interested in how that person is doing? I read a story about a little 8-year-old boy named Robert Williams. Every morning he'd go out and catch the school bus. When he'd get on the school bus, his school bus driver was a woman named Louise. She'd always look at him and say, all right, did you have breakfast this morning? Mm-hmm. Did you do your homework, prepare for school? Mm-hmm.
How are your grades doing? Do you feel okay? Anything bothering you? You need to talk to me about? She did this for him every single day. He said, it touched my life because he said, when I was a very young kid, my dad decided he didn't want to be married to my mom, and he just left us. And my mom was left to raise me and 8 other kids. But he said, it took a toll on my mother's life, and her health began to fail. He said, by the time he got to late elementary age, he realized he needed to do something to help his mom. He said he began to study all the bus drivers, how they all wore uniforms. And his mother, he asked his mother, would you teach me how to sew? So she taught him how to sew. So he went and made a uniform for himself as a school bus driver. He went to the school bus parking lot, saw a bus with keys in it, got in it, and drove off. Other bus drivers called in saying, we think there's a small kid driving a school bus down the street. So police were notified. They set up a roadblock and stopped him. When the police officer got him off the bus, he said, what are you doing? He said, well, my mom's health is failing, and I just wanted to do something to help her. Because you see, I have this school bus driver named Miss Louise. She's always very interested in how I'm doing. And it's not she's just asking questions. She sincerely wants to know. Well, the police didn't want to charge him. They said they'd let him out on probation if he promised not to do it again. He promised he would keep his nose clean. In fact, the HR director of the bus driving system said, when you're old enough, come back and I'll give you a job. When he turned 25, he was old enough to be a school bus driver. He contacted the bus company and the director, who remembered the incident. He said, I completed my training, and I went up personally to Miss Louise and thanked her for the impact she had on my life, because I knew every morning when she asked me those questions, it wasn't a ritual she was going through. She was genuinely concerned about my well-being and how I was doing. And he said, the only reason I'm a bus driver is because of her. He went on to become a supervisor, and he later retired from it. Don't forget, these are the days in Jerusalem and in Israel where Jews decided what was right and wrong. Morality's gone out the window. It was all subjective. You decide what's right and wrong. Boaz cares more about his peasants working for him than he does about anything else. He's a godly man. They've come out of this horrible famine. He wants to provide for them. And many times in churches when we come to worship or we come here on Sunday morning, someone asks you, how are you doing? Do you just give the cultural expected response? Fine. I'm doing okay. What do you think would happen if you honestly told that person how you are really doing? What would you think would happen? See, I've often wondered when the Bible commands us to share our concerns with each other, why Christians are often hesitant to do that. Who else can we depend upon but each other and the Lord Jesus Christ? Do we just see prayer as a job we have to do to get on to something else? It is my prayer for our church that we would be open and honest with each other. If you walk in here on Sunday morning and it's been a bad weekend, I don't mind you telling me that. I'll pray with you right there. Because I want you to see and I want you to believe that no matter how bad it is now, God's working behind the scenes. He will remove these dark clouds eventually. And on the canvas of Scripture, the portrait of Boaz is a very godly and righteous man. He has integrity. He's honest. He has humility. He's diligent. He has character, and he gives all the credit for the good in his life to God. I imagine he wasn't all that interested in the local girls because they probably just wanted to marry him for his money. He probably talked about God too much, would upset a lot of other people. But Boaz wasn't interested in settling for someone of lesser character and trivial interest. He wanted to honor God with his life. Look at Judges 21:25. It says this, in the days of the judges, this is the day of Boaz, the day of Ruth, the day of Naomi, Israel had no king, so the people did whatever seemed right in their own eyes and opinion. They're making up morality from day to day. So in the days of Boaz and Ruth and Naomi, righteousness and holiness and godliness has gone out the window. There is no morality except what you determine for yourself. But Boaz is this unique man standing alone against a culture that has walked away from God. He is going to stand for God no matter what. And God will use him to influence others in the same way. Number three, to really influence people for God, here's what you need to be. You need to be passionately connected to God even when others around you are passionately disconnected from God. Imagine in the self-serving culture Boaz was living. Here's a wealthy man. He will ride out into his fields. He will check on his workers. He will invoke God's blessings upon them and say, I'm so grateful you're working for me. The Bible is very clear. He not just paid, he paid them more. He cared about his workers. He passed on the blessings of God that God had given him to his workers. He connected to them, even though they may not have been connected to God. His tribesmen may have lost their conviction in God, but he has not. I mean, I think it's interesting that Boaz's first recorded words reveals nothing than a passionate connection he had to God. He greets his workers with something like this. Listen, God is not only worth following, but I hope you will intensely sense his presence in the field as you work today. So if you want to influence other people for God, you've got to stay connected to God, even if they're not. Here's the fourth thing. To really influence workers, influence people today, here's what you need to be. You need to be self-sacrificing when everyone else around you is self-serving. Over vacation, one of the things I did was occasionally check the news, see what was going on. I'm just amazed how more self-centered our culture is becoming. It's all about me. It's all about what I want. I could care less about anybody else. What we see with Boaz, he is self-sacrificing. This was a time when everybody did what they wanted to do and decided what was right and wrong in their own eyes. Boaz is a man who cares about his people. He cares about his relationship to God. So he's going to work and be caring and loving even to the lowest class in his day. Why? Because he knows the Old Testament law commands him to do so. And this is why he does it. Let me show it to you. Leviticus 19 says, when you harvest the crops of your land, do not harvest the grain along the edges of your fields, and do not pick up what the harvesters drop. It is the same with your grape crop. Do not strip every last bunch of grapes from the vines, and do not pick up the grapes that fall to the ground. Leave them for the poor and the foreigners living among you. I am the Lord your God. The law of Moses dictated that they had the freedom to grow crops, they had the freedom to harvest those crops, but on the edges of that farmland, they had to leave that for the poor and for foreigners. And now coming out of a famine, farmers were not doing that. Whatever fell to the ground, they sent their workers back to get it again. They're not going to share anything, especially to a Moabite woman who they considered unclean, who they considered a foreigner. I mean, who in their right mind would care for people in a day of coming out of famine? Boaz. That's who he is. So let me ask you, what do you leave behind for the less fortunate, the poor, the ignored, and the hopeless? When you're in a conversation with someone, do you glean through what they are saying and not saying? Do you look for the body language, the tone, to see what they're not saying, to pick up of how God could use you to help that person? Or do you just move on to the next thing? You see, because Boaz accepted the burden of obeying the law in Leviticus, he will actually discover his future bride-to-be named Ruth. Look at it in Ruth 2. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, now I want you to notice here how the prophet Samuel does this. He continues to call Ruth a Moabite, not to be racially prejudiced, but to let us know the racial prejudice against Ruth living in Bethlehem. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor. And she said to her, go, my daughter. So she went out and went and gleaned in the fields of the reapers. In those days when they were gleaning fields of wheat or barley, gleaners would carry a sickle in one hand and they would reach down and grab some wheat or barley and cut off the stalk. Okay? And they would drop that stalk, or they would keep holding more stalk as they could, and then they would tie it up and leave it on the ground for people to come behind them and pick it up, or they would just drop it on the ground and those handlers would come back and tie them up and put them in a cart and take them away. And so that's what she's going to go out. She's going to go out and get her a sickle, and she's going to cut off some wheat and barley so that they can live. And in those days, the poor were not being anything left behind for them. Boaz, the way the scripture words it, is about the only landowner allowing people, foreigners, to come, the poor to come, and glean from his fields. You see, living as a gleaner back then would be as difficult as trying to recycle aluminum cans to a recycling center. The greedier the farmer, the less they're going to leave behind. And what Samuel is wanting us to know is that Boaz honored God in the Old Testament law. I will do what God says, and God blesses him for it. So much so, what he doesn't know is God's setting him up to meet his future wife. Look at Ruth 2, 3b. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. If you could read Hebrew, you would see it literally puts it this way. She chanced upon the field. Now, in our English grammar, that doesn't make sense. Okay? But in Hebrew, sometimes they write it in a way that you emphasize a word. We say something similar. We'll say, can you believe that happened? Oh my gosh, can you believe that happened? We do it too. We just say it with many words. Hebrew uses one word, and the way they place it means say the same word again. It's for emphasis. And Samuel is saying, this wasn't just a chance. This just wasn't a coincidence. This was the providence of God working to bring these two people together. And I imagine Samuel smiled when he wrote that. Yes, Ruth goes to this field. There was no voice saying, Ruth, turn left, go down a half mile, turn right. And there's a voice to turn. He just says she happened to come to this place. This is the way he says God was engineering her to get there. Again, it reminds me of Proverbs 3:6. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he shall direct your paths. I like how John Piper writes about the providence of God. He says, life is not a straight line leading from one blessing to the next and finally to heaven. Life is like a winding and troubled road, switchback after switchback. And the point of biblical stories like Joseph and Job and Esther and Ruth is to help us feel in our bones, not just know in our heads, that God is for us in all these strange turns. God is not just showing up after the trouble and cleaning it up. He is plotting the course and managing the troubles with far-reaching purposes for our good and for the glory of Jesus Christ. Most of you know the Old Testament story about Joseph. He's the 11th brother of 12 brothers. And the Bible leads us to believe that he was the favorite son of the 12. And his father played this up. And it created jealousy among the 12 brothers. And Joseph got a little chip on his shoulder. Remember, his father gave him this robe that was multicolored. And he would walk around, parade it around, say, see, I'm daddy's favorite. And his brothers got ticked off about it. And age 17, they decided, we got to get rid of him. We got to kill him. And then when they couldn't kill him, they said, well, let's fake his killing. So they sold him to Midianite traders. They took his robe, killed a lamb, dipped it in blood, took it back to their dad and said, oh, we hate to report this, but your favorite son, Joseph, is dead. And then Jacob weeps and mourns the loss of Joseph. Joseph thinks his life is over. He is sold eventually by these Midianite traders to a guy named Potiphar, who is in the royal cabinetry of Pharaoh. And he becomes a slave to Potiphar and Potiphar's household. And through the story, if you remember, Potiphar's wife accuses him of making inappropriate sexual advances at her. So he's thrown into prison. And while he's in prison, he encounters a cupbearer to the king and a baker for the king who are also been thrown into prison because they've ticked off the king. And they begin to have these strange dreams. And it disturbs them so much they can't figure out what the dream is about. Joseph said, well, God has given me the ability to interpret dreams. Tell me your dream. So he tells the cupbearer. The cupbearer tells him the dream. And Joseph says, well, here's what the dream means. In 3 days, you will be restored to your position. And you will have life and you'll serve the king. The baker says, well, let me tell you my dream. And he tells him the dream. What does it mean? Joseph said, well, in 3 days, you'll be brought before Pharaoh. And you'll be impaled on a pole for the birds to eat. And that is exactly what happened. You got to keep in mind, 13, years go by as this is taking place. He's serving as a slave, missing home, missing food, missing his brothers, missing his family. He thinks God has abandoned him. He thinks God has turned his world upside down. He thinks he's all alone. Then the Pharaoh starts having this disturbing dream. Do you remember that? And all of a sudden, the cupbearer says, Pharaoh, there's a guy working here as a slave to Potiphar. He can interpret dreams. Pharaoh says, fine, bring him in, because none of my magicians can tell me what these dreams mean. He brings Joseph in. They get him all cleaned up. And Pharaoh tells him the dream, and Joseph says, here's what your dreams mean. There will be 7 years of great blessing, followed by 7 years of famine. Here's what I would do if I was you, O Pharaoh. I would stock up food during those 7 years of plenty for the 7 years of famine. And Pharaoh says, I tell you what, I don't know anybody to do that than you. And he appoints him as prime minister over Egypt. Think about this. He goes from prisoner to prime minister just like that. He thinks God has abandoned him. But God was working behind the scenes to take care of not only Joseph, but the tribe of Israel. And you remember the story? His brothers come to buy food because the famine is so widespread, it goes through Israel. And eventually, Joseph reveals himself to his brothers. They don't know it's Joseph. I've had people ask me, why don't they know it's Joseph? Well, he's 30 years old. 13 years have gone by. He's dressing like an Egyptian. He's got all the makeup, the robe, the garb. He's only speaking Egyptian to them. He uses a translator to speak to his brothers, even though he can speak Hebrew. But all of a sudden, the light comes on. What he thought had been abandonment by God, he sees as the providence of God. Look at this in Genesis 45:5. Don't be upset and don't be angry with yourselves for selling me to this place. It was God who sent me here ahead of you to preserve your lives. Southside, whatever's going on in your life, however bad it is, however tragic it is, God is working behind the scenes to help you with it. Boaz and Ruth are proof of God's providence, of his promise to take care of you, to work all things out for the good. Now, you and I may not have any flashing lights or voices from heaven, but if you will listen to that tender voice called the Holy Spirit in your life, God will work things out for you. Even David understood this. Look what David writes in Psalm 37. The Lord directs the steps of the godly. He delights in every detail of their lives. Ruth is out gleaming in the field, which will be her potential, owned by her potential kinsman redeemer. The Bible says Boaz just happened to see her in the field as he comes to visit. He says to his workers, may the Lord be with you. And they say to him, may the Lord bless you. I love what verse 5 says. At this moment, Boaz spots Ruth. When you were dating, did you ever walk into your classroom or walk into a restaurant or walk into some place and you go, who is that? Look at it. Look at verse 5. Then Boaz said to his young man who was in charge of the reapers, whose young woman is this? In case you miss it, that's Hebrew with, wow, who's that? That's Hebrew for that. He might have whistled. Now, today I wouldn't encourage you guys to do that because you might be whistling as a transgender guy who's dressed up like a woman, okay? I wouldn't do that today. But Boaz kind of go, whoa! Who, what woman is that? Man, is she hot? I'm stretching it a little bit there, but you get the point. I love what Stephen Davey writes about when his daughters were growing up. He said this, I remember whistling that way to my older daughter when she was around 4 years old, that little, you know. She didn't know what that particular whistle meant, and I wanted her to know ahead of time when she got to be a teenager and later when she was going to go off to college. I sat down with her, and I said, honey, one of these days, some young man will drive up next to you, roll down his window, and whistle just like that in your direction. It means he thinks you're pretty, and he wants your attention. So when he does, spit in his window and run home to daddy. Boaz whistles. Oh, my goodness gracious. Who is that woman? You see, God had been working behind the scenes to get these two couples together, Boaz and Ruth. Why? So that there'd be a marriage to bring Obed, to bring Jesse, to bring King David, and 1,000 years later, Jesus Christ. The story of Ruth is one of the best stories of the Bible, of God's providence, working behind the scenes to help you and help me. Look at verses 6 through 7. The servant answered, "She is a young Moabite woman." Now, in this case, Samuel lets us know the servant is using it as a racial slur. She's a young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. She said, "Please let me follow the workers cutting grain and gather what they have leave behind." She came and has remained here from morning until just now. She has stopped only for a few moments to rest in the shelter. She's caught Boaz's eye. And what Ruth doesn't know is that Boaz is the nephew to his uncle, Elimelech, who gives him the biblical right to be the kinsman redeemer to Ruth. And what we're going to see is she's going to carry home more grain than anyone ever did in Israel because of his kindness and generosity. It's kind of like when I thought about this. I remember my single years when I was dating. And women, you may not realize this. When a guy goes to ask a girl out for the first time, he is scared to death. Because what if she says no? I mean, he's crushed. If she says yes, he's ready to go. But we get nervous when we go to you and say, "Hey, would you like to go on a date?" Boaz is kind of moving fillers behind the scene. Who is this woman? Because he wants to know how to approach her. Look at verses 8 through 9. Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Listen, my daughter, stay here in my field to gather grain for yourself. Do not go to any other person's field." Look at that. "Continue following behind my women workers. Watch to see which fields they go and follow them. I have warned the young men not to bother you. When you are thirsty, you may go drink. Take water from the water jugs that the servants have filled." So Boaz says, "Hey, I'm going to bring you under my protection." In those days, they had water coolers, water jugs filled with water. Since Ruth is a foreigner, she would have had to walk all the way back into Bethlehem to get her water and then come back to the field. He says, "I'm not going to allow that to happen. You're going to drink from the same water jugs that my women workers drink from." Did you notice that Boaz has already commanded his men not to bother Ruth? This Hebrew word that's translated as bother, neged, it can mean to harm, abuse, or sexually molest and rape. You see, a Moabite woman is considered a foreigner. She's considered unclean. It would be, in that culture, okay for those Jewish men to rape her, to sexually harass her, sexually molest her. And so by what Boaz does, he's already told his men, "You keep your hands off of her. She's under my protection. I'm her guardian. You see to it that every need she has is met." Look at verse 10. Ruth fell at his feet and thanked him warmly. "What have I done to deserve such kindness?" she asked. "I'm only a foreigner." She knows her position in that culture. She doesn't know Boaz's position in terms of his relationship to Naomi. So Boaz proceeds to tell her. Look at verse 11. "Yes, I know, Boaz, but I also know about everything you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband. I have also heard how you left your father and mother and your own land to live here among complete strangers." He's saying, "Ruth, I know everything about you. I already checked you out. I've got the full scoop on you. I know about your marriage. I know about your loss of your husband. I know about Naomi. I know everything about her. I also know that you have decided to accept the God of Israel, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I see that in your life. I see that you're worth protecting. I see that you're worth honoring." Look at verse 12. Ruth says, "May the Lord reward your work and your wages be full from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge." Boaz says to her, "Listen, I'm going to protect you." And when I thought about this, why hasn't the church heard more about Boaz? Why aren't there more books written about this man? His beliefs, for any men's group, he is a great man to study. His belief in Scripture, his honoring of God in his life, his character is worth following. Now they've just met, and he's already talking about God. He's doing more than just dropping God's name. He's letting Ruth know up front, I love God with all my heart, soul, mind, and strength. Ruth, I know what happened when you left your family, your friends, your country. I know what's going on in your life right now. So listen, dear girl. Just come and snuggle up under the wings of the Almighty God and be assured he's going to use me to watch over you and to protect you. And I pray that he will repay you for your kind deeds you did to your mother-in-law, Naomi. Now, when we come to verse 13, if you read translations, there's all kinds of ways they translate it. If you can read Hebrew, if you could read Hebrew, you'll see it's very difficult to translate. And when I read it, I struggled with it. I went to commentary after commentary to figure out what's the best translation of this. And here's what the best translation of verse 13 says. Ruth says to Boaz, you have spoken kindly and compassionately to me, my Lord, even though I am a foreigner. I will never be in the same standing nor equivalent to you, to your other maidservants. Can you imagine that? She says, sir, thank you for your kindness. I'm just scum. I'm just a Moabite foreigner. I'm a nobody. There's no way I could even work or be compared to your other servants, these women working in the field. I mean, when I read that, I thought Boaz could have proposed right there to her. So as I wrap up, let me give you two quick things this tells me about romantic relationships. Here's the first one. The foundation for any romantic relationship is this. It has to have a vital relationship with Jesus Christ. And if you're single and you're dating, you need to make sure that whoever you're dating has a vital relationship with Jesus Christ. If that girl or that guy that you're wanting to date does not have that, you don't need to date them. Or they may acknowledge God, or they may come to church. They may walk into here. But are they building this relationship to Jesus Christ? Let me put it to you this way. Don't let your growing hormones make the decision. Let a holy God make your decision. When I do premarital counseling, there are things I look for in a couple's relationship. I've seen countless couples come for advice for this, how to prepare for marriage. And one is totally committed to God and the other is not. I've pointed out that this is a warning sign. This is a danger sign. That they're going to go off in two different directions spiritually. And I've had people say, but I love him. But I love her. And my response is, it takes more than love to have a marriage. Or they say, well, you know, he or she walked an aisle when they were a teenager and gave their life to Christ. That's not the issue. The issue is, are they walking today with God? I've lost count of the number of spouses through my years in ministry who come and sit in these pews all by themselves because their spouse won't come. That spouse who comes and sits in these pews cannot share the most important, intimate, vital thing in their life with that spouse. Their personal relationship with Jesus Christ. And if you're dating, you need to make sure that you're totally committed to Christ and that person you're dating is totally committed to Christ. Here's the way I look at it. It's far better to be standing on the shore wishing you could sail than to be sailing and wishing you were on the shore. Here's the second thing. To have a great relationship, a permanent attraction between a man and a woman should be beyond the physical to include the spiritual. Yes, looks often attract us. That's okay. There's nothing wrong in that. But it needs to go deeper than the physical. I love what J. Vernon McGee writes about this. He says that nowhere in the book of Ruth are we told what Ruth looked like. Not one physical description is given, not even the color of her eyes. Ruth appeals to Boaz not because of her looks, but because of her walk with Christ. That's what got Boaz's attention. And because of that, they will eventually marry. Eventually become David, and 1,000 years later, Jesus Christ. The book of Ruth is about how God works behind the scenes to accomplish his will when all seems hopeless. Let's pray. You've heard the word of God today. Now it's up to you to decide what you're going to do with it. Are you going to fill in the blanks? Say, okay, I got my blanks filled in. And go out to eat and go about your week. Or are you going to take what you've learned today, apply it to your life? all of us right now have things going on in our life we wish we could change. All of us. There's people we wish would come to Christ. There are things going on in a marriage you wish were not there. There may be hardship with your children or your adult children. You're at odds with each other. There may be tension at work. Maybe tension with a neighbor. My question is, are you going to give it to God, live out your life for God, and allow God to work behind the scenes to work this out? That's what the book of Ruth is about. God working behind the scenes when you can't see it and I don't see it, to accomplish his will in the midst of the decisions you make, I make, and everyone else around us makes. This invitation is for you. You can come and kneel here and pray and give this to God. You can pray there in the pew if you prefer.